Bienvenue sur Radio Créum. Welcome to Radio Créum. This is a special recording of the Breaking the Silence Conference on the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada that took place at the University of Montreal on September 26th and 27th in 2008. You will now hear part 5 of the recording, which features Maxime Saint-Hilaire as rapporteur of the second panel, followed by the questions and comments of the public.
Alors, pour la synthèse, le rapport, en fait, je passe la parole à Maxime Saint-Hilaire, qui est chercheur attaché au CREUM, qui est l'organisateur de ce colloque. Alors.
Merci.
Well, I would like to first thank the speakers for their very helpful talks. Well, I say helpful because I think they can be easily and fruitfully related to the commission's work. Well, I'm not gonna talk so much about what we heard this morning, but still, this morning, Mr. Gonzalez talked about a trade-off. Well, he said a truth and reconciliation commission should proceed from a trade-off approach, kind of a middle of the path solution in between a more punitive, like punishment approach, and restorative justice. Well, what Christian Nadeau has said, I think, is clearly consistent with this line. Christian Nadeau stressed that restorative justice is no absolute principle of justice. It's not an absolute solution to take. It has no absolute value. So according to Christian Nadeau, it would be better to reconcile reconciliation with justice by a commitment or, I mean, according to my understanding, even maybe a guarantee of this will never happen. Well, in this case, it's certainly some form of justice that is partly set aside, namely judicial justice. According to what I've heard today, I think it might be part of the public the commission's public relations job, maybe to explain a little bit more to the public that choice of such a commission rather than a more judicial process, because it sounds like a lot of people are wondering about that choice, and yeah, I think it must be maybe more explained or justified publicly. That's my opinion of it. It was, I mean, colonization as well this morning is something that came pretty often. It's something that struck me, that I found really interesting in Val Napoleon's talk. Well, the idea of what I would put in those terms, like some form of colonization of the self, as a form of suffering, I think is clearly an ethical challenge of the commission. More precisely, what's an ethical challenge here is to be sensitive to that very particular form of suffering. Well, we all know that listening is not understanding, and I think it was very very useful to mention that challenge. It's really important, I think, for the commission to be aware of that form of suffering that might not be spoken out, I mean, explicitly. Another aspect that is very important as an ethical challenge for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission on Residential Schools is that other form of suffering that is also, I think, particular, which is that loss of agency, that is, yeah, a form of suffering, that is for sure, but also something to heal from, I guess, I would say in English. So, I mean, with these ethical challenges in mind, these challenges the Commission has to meet, maybe we can summarize by saying the Commission will have to strike a subtle and perhaps very tricky balance between the individual reality of suffering and the political aspect of reconciliation. And I think that aspect, that political aspect, certainly helps explain the choice of such a commission. I'm now turning to Dale Turner's presentation. I think as kind of both a lawyer and a philosopher, what I found particularly interesting in Dale's presentation is the fact, I mean, it underlined the constitutive role of the positive and constitutional law in ethical challenges. Focused on the Supreme Court's interpretation and construction of Article 35. It is true to me that, I mean, it's a good thing. We can be happy with the fact that the Supreme Court, according to the distinctive culture test in Vanderpeet, has said that we have to be sensitive to the Aboriginal perspective. But it is also true that as long as, according to that subsuming requisite, we have to put that Aboriginal perspective kind of under to make it depending upon the Canadian state sovereignty principle, I think it's still problematic. So it can be kind of a useless it can be like a fake principle or a fake opening to the Aboriginal perspective. That's what I mean. So, I mean, if we relate this to our case, to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission on residential schools, well, I think what Dale said is that the commission would have to aim at some form, horizontal type of reconciliation, and less vertical, of course. Probably the commission's ability to be sensitive to the colonization of the self that Napoleon talked about as a form of suffering will be dependent on the ability of the commissioners to take that more horizontal type of form of reconciliation. Well, so this is all what I had to say. Thanks again for your talk.
Thank you very much, Maxim. Okay, Mister, micro un.
What I had was a 2.5 page statement, but I think I'll cut it short, and there are some questions in there, in my statement, which I have copies of, by the way, if anyone wants those. My name is Eric Large, Saddle Lake Cree Nation, Alberta. I have experience as a residential school survivor. I'm called a survivor. 12 years. And right now I'm also a resolution health support worker. So in this 2.5 page statement, I outlined some challenges, four of them among many others. So on page 2 here, I am sharing these questions with you. You don't need to answer them. I have to find out and take ownership to try to solve them as a survivor and as a First Nation member. So therefore, I ask myself, is it ethical for any individual or institution to focus only on the former IRS students, such as myself, who are the main beneficiaries of the IRSA, meaning IRSA is the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. Then I go on to say, well, conciliatory strategies pursuant to the TNRC not only heal the deep emotional and psychological harms of former IRS students, or lead to the healing of attitudes and historical misperceptions of institutions, such as schools, universities, the legal system, churches, other professions, governments, the media, entertainment industry, etc. What I'm trying to say is the focus should not be just on us, like we're always needing to be helped or to be healed, but also the attitudes that are out there and the general public. And there are, unfortunately, some attitudes, as we all know, still exist, such as Indigenous First Peoples or Indians, we call also Indians in quotes, still live in teepees, or assume that all Indians are prone to alcoholism. When a few are seen in the Skid Row part of urban areas, related questions also are, what is healing? Can it be measured? At what point in time can healing be said to have occurred, if at all? Can the financial and emotional cost to the former students, their families, their community, and to the Canadian government be calculated? Is healing a journey or an ongoing process rather than an objective? How can catastrophic harms of the mind, body, and emotions ever be healed? These are just the questions that I have to explore myself in consultation with my people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Some comments, or we can take, or Val?
Thank you for sharing that. One of the things that I think we have to figure out how to do is to have the kinds of difficult conversations we need to in our communities. So in my community, we need to talk about, we need to create intellectual space. We need to figure out how, what's the power structures in our communities, the different patterns of violence in our community. And we need to look at how we've bought in to the different constructs of ourselves as a dysfunctional people, as a people who are in a cultural deficit, as if we didn't have a legal order on which we could draw. We need to be able to create a space to have that conversation with one another, to look at our responsibility in perpetuation of violence. Once we can have those difficult conversations there, we can change the kinds of conversations we have with the state and institutions of the state. But somewhere we need to create that space for to develop our own intellectual capacity in our families and at the local level.
Thank you. Microphone number two, Madame.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Llewellyn from Dalhousie Law School. I wanted to thank the panel very much. I found a very enriching conversation, and I'm glad to see the questions around justice continuing to occupy some space in the conversation and its relationship to reconciliation. I'm a little concerned that in this conversation there seems to be a sort of a, we must find a middle ground between restorative justice and retributive justice in a way that I think characterizes restorative justice and an end with forgiveness and healing. And I know where that comes from in terms of some of the religious discourses. But there are other discourses around restorative justice that place accountability at the central core, accountability and responsibility, in ways that I think don't make that an easy trade-off. And I think that's partly around the language that's gone on internationally for strategic reasons to align impunity with the absence of traditional Western-style prosecution and punishment, when in fact we probably ought to be thinking about avoiding impunity in terms of avoiding circumstances and institutions that don't bring accountability. And so I'm interested to know, insofar as I understand and root restorative justice in relational conceptions of justice, and in this context, I'm interested that many of those notions borrow heavily and are heavily inspired and informed by Aboriginal conceptions of justice that are at their core rooted in a relational understanding of selves and the world. Why that richer notion rather than the sort of religious invocation of healing and reconciliation at a restoring of personal relationship level, which is actually not the richer understanding of restorative justice at work in sort of national institutions, is being laid on the table in a way that I don't think allows us to engage in what's really at stake here, which is a conversation about how to be accountable and responsible in a way that takes seriously ourselves and connection to one another as relational beings. And so I just wanted to place that on the table as a bit more of a complex conversation than I think is happening with this trying to seek middle space that I think we have in many examples and predominantly in Aboriginal conceptions of justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Someone just jump there.
Thanks for your comment. I totally agree with you, so it's difficult to respond to your question. Just want to add that, for my part, transitional justice or a truth and reconciliation commission could be seen as a kind of political tool that the state could use in order to get rid of the past and not to fix something. So if it is a political tool, and it could be a political tool, and I think it is, it should be used by both parts, even the natives and the states. So I think that's why I insist a lot about the institutional relation between wrongdoers and the natives.
Val?
There is a false dichotomy that has been created in the discourse of restorative justice, which has, I think, captured a lot of what are called Aboriginal justice initiatives. And in that gap that has been created, there's little recognition of Indigenous legal norms, Indigenous legal orders, and Indigenous law. And part of what happens is there's an assumption that the only law there is Western or Canadian, and it's bad. And so all of the attention is focused on trying to be different from the Canadian legal system. What that means, as Indigenous people, we don't pay attention to our norms and the way that we're responsible to one another through our own laws. We have simplified our own legal orders in order to fit that dichotomy. So we've trapped ourselves in that story. I think that a more interesting and productive line of inquiry would be to look at current Aboriginal justice initiatives as well as other initiatives and to seek the legal norms that underlie people's actions in those communities so that we can understand people still acting on their historic legal norms. We need to change the language. It's not helpful to us, and it detracts from the kinds of conversations we need to develop.
Merci beaucoup.
Microphone. Good afternoon. Thank you. Ending on that note, we have to change the language. I represent the Saskatchewan Indian Cultural Centre in Saskatoon. 74 bands, 8 different language groups, Dakota, Dene, Lakota, Nakota, the Cree Y, the Cree N Swampy, Plains, and the Woodland. It's our mandate that we support the language needs of the communities in the cultural context. As you know, we have our own language, our laws that are governed originally by the Creator. That's who set our laws, and we believe in that. We have our own history, our own language, our methodologies, our own cultures. Our ceremonies, which are mostly oral and not written. One cannot represent the other, as we are all unique. And we can't continue to be put in a melting pot and treated as one Indigenous peoples. We are different. As far as the Creator called Neheosko. It wasn't Plains Cree, whatever whose language that was. There is an inequity in the funding of languages in Canada, in the status of the languages in Canada, and our status of our languages in Saskatchewan. There is inequity in the research. Since arrival of Europeans in Canada, you've had the privilege and advantage to advance yourselves, your libraries. When our elder dies, it's like a whole library burning down. And when you consider the Shirk and Cures, all the research monies that's gone into the building, the libraries, even one article in a journal could have cost $1 million as a result of a 4-page report. And here, we haven't had increase in our funding at SICC for 30 years, $1 million for 74 bands. And the French last year, I understand they got like over $36 million just on French language. What more can be done to the French language? I know we need more development in that area. We heal through our language. Our language has a language of healing, Kanatoso. We haven't been given the opportunity to even teach our children in our schools, in the communities, our knowledge. We are obligated as parents to link our elders with the children, and we are that tool to pass that knowledge on. But we are, oppressed in different ways, as you are aware. There is a definite loss of language and culture. You know, we have to honor those that who had the tenacity and the courage to continue to speak our languages and pass that on to myself while you're getting beatings in residential school, and that courage to go ahead and pass that on to those of us who are products of the products of those who were in the residential school. How is it that this commission, how are they going to settle, or how are they going to deal with this loss of language and culture? Are we on the agenda? And it's pretty devastating in communities where those of them who were in residential schools sit at the tables and make policies, but don't speak their language and can't communicate the world views of our people. So that was a question, is where and how, when you think of ethics, Indian Affairs, Shirk, Kira, there is no policies. They haven't even begun to explore. They have begun to explore, but they are not definite yet on the different protocols. We're still arguing about it and debating about it academically. And in the communities, part of it, when we are in a melting pot, everybody wants to be right, everybody wants to do their protocols, and we need to respect each and every unique tribe, nation that's in this country. I have that question.
Okay, Dale.
Thank you very much for that. One of the things you said is I find really interesting, yet I don't quite understand what to do with it, which is I think there's a difference in speaking a language and then thinking in that language. And for example, my grandfather spoke Anishinaabe as his first language. He didn't even learn English till he was a boy. My father speaks it as a second language, and I speak next to nothing. Any language that I have learned is similar to what I did in French class in grade 6. this word means this, you know, the type of thing, although I have been asking a lot of questions about concepts and things like that. I'd like to just set that aside for a second. One of the things also that when I originally naively thought, this is not often you see the chair actually have the, yeah. That must be Jeremy Waldron actually calling me to. thinking that studying Western European philosophy, I was going to find some answers to how to deal with how a court could distort our understandings of our relationships to our lands. One of the things I thought was, well, all I have to do is learn the history of ideas. You know, I read my Hobbes, Locke. Now you do need to throw it. I just need to read my Hobbes, my Locke, my Rousseau, and maybe a little Hegel, not too much Hegel. These sorts of things, and just it's a matter of knowledge. It's just a matter of knowing, these sorts of things. But when I started reading Las Casas, and on the, a little short book called On the Devastation of the Indies. And I think there's another one where he has a defense of the Indians. I really made me think that of how Indians and indigenous peoples have become the idea of the of an of the indigenous is so deeply embedded in Western the Western European psyche as barbaric, and that any time indigenous peoples are discussed, there's this sort of implicit, and I don't know how to get at that. Maybe psychoanalysis or something, or I don't know. You mentioned Joe Gunn, and I know that this is the kind of thing that really interests him, which is how is it that when we have a discussion, never mind getting to policy, but when we have a discussion over meaning or epistemology or something like this, that it's just implicit that indigenous understandings, indigenous ways of thinking are not included as relevant. They're not part of what I think the limits of an imagination, an imaginary in a Western European discourse about something like what is knowledge or what is the real or what is a good life and these kinds of things. And indigenous peoples have very complex, systematic explanations for these and answers to these kinds of questions, and most of them are articulated in their own languages. So, in a sense, then I see that one of the ways of getting at how we can better protect that, because I don't see anytime soon, anyway, this especially within the thinking of policy, how indigenous peoples are going to be, as you said, horizontal, be recognized and respected as equals in a conversation. I just don't see that happening. I see that we need, at least at this point in the relationship, to force our way in some sense into gaining political forms of empowerment. And one way at this, I think, which is to look back into our communities ourselves and to ask ourselves, what is it that we want to protect and that we refuse to discuss in the dominant with the dominant culture? And it seems like anytime we go into a court of law, we are expected to explain ourselves. And Aboriginal peoples have been doing this for 500 years, been explaining ourselves. It hasn't gone very far. And I think that part of what's happened with that is that we've come to ourselves to believe that we are not our rightful place is not to participate in these kinds of dialogues about justice. That's a sort of another realm that smart people talk about or educated white people talk about. And so one way, I think, is for this a kind of dialogue within communities to decide what it is that we want to protect and to keep within our communities and in a sense be non-negotiable. And what is it that we are willing to talk about, but more importantly, how do we do so? How do we do so in ways where we know, you know, who Jeremy Waldron is, who this discourse of rights and sovereignty and nationhood and all of these sorts of things that take years and years and years to understand, but at the same time, coming from these communities that have these rich worldviews, these ways of being in the world that perhaps, I don't know, are incommensurable with Western European ways of being. And then there are people who move between those worlds. So I think one of the ways, and I've written about this, is in how we educate our children and how we raise our children to think about themselves, and so that when they leave school, and I see this at Dartmouth all the time, when they come to school, the community knows that these kids are going to come back. And they're going to come back in ways where they're going to understand that they can participate in these legal, political, social worlds that are largely determined by languages of the dominant culture, ways of thinking of the dominant culture, but at the same time, that they bring to that a perspective that ought to play a role in shaping these kinds of intellectual landscapes. And I think that we're starting to see our young people doing that. You're starting to see these word warriors who speak their own languages, who know their own ceremonies, who have their own belief systems, and they hold on to those quite strongly, and they know who they are, while at the same time they're able to talk about, you know, rights and philosophy and Wittgenstein and all this kind of stuff. Maybe not Wittgenstein, but... So I think that this idea of language and how we articulate what is something that we need to talk about more among ourselves, and it's a distinctly indigenous problem, because what is it about what we're asserting, this kind of forms of distinctiveness, what is it about it that we want to hold on to in this ongoing political relationship?
Thank you, Dale. Do you need to call someone? Okay. Okay, it's okay. We have microphone number two.
Hi, thank you. Dale, this is a question for you, but it's a little bit of a tangent. In the previous panel, we were looking at Truth and Reconciliation Commissions elsewhere as perhaps models or that could provide some sort of guidance for us here in Canada. And then today you brought up the Royal Commission, and you said that we have some 200 feet of archival material on previous exercises of truth-telling, but that there might be some lost in the translation in language of policy. So my question is, are we repeating the exercise, and what are we expecting or hoping that will be come out new this time in our present quest? Thank you.
I think what I just said before probably answers that question, but so I'll repeat it. I think it's a very good question, because I think a lot of people think of RCAP as a failure. You know, they don't call it RCAP, they call it crap. And I don't think that's quite right. I think one of the things that should come out of all of this is it seems that there's a right time and place for certain things to happen. And what was the commission able to do, given its period of time in Canadian history? It did fall on the heels of OCA. OCA was a very nasty time to be living in Montreal, and there was a great deal of frustration on many different sides. But I think I remember Mary Ellen Turpel said once, you know, the most important thing that's going to come out of the commission's work is the archive, and the fact that they took this time to actually listen to what Aboriginal peoples had to say. And I think there's some truth to that. The other thing I think that it helped do was, I remember when they were deciding what to do with the final report, they were going to start the first chapter was going to be on the principles of the renewed relationship. And so they were going to lay out these principles. And then as the life of the commission unfolded, they realized, one of the things I think that the commissioners did realize, is that Canadians know next to nothing about Aboriginal peoples, and they know very little about their own history. And I think the virtue of the first volume, which everybody agrees, I think the final report needs a good edit, but I think that the virtue of Volume 1 is that it does lay out the different stages or the views of that historical relationship. So I think that but that needs to get out there. You know, people need to actually read this, and it needs to be brought into classrooms and that sort of thing. So I do see that as a pretty valuable, I don't know if it's worth $60 million, one of the things that the commission wrestled with too, and you see this in the second volume, is that they constrained their legal political analysis to within Canada. The nation-to-nation view was within Canada. And there were a lot of Native peoples, especially the Iroquoian people, who's not just Iroquoian people, but who say, well, we don't want to see the and understand the political relationship in that way. So that makes Section 35 problematic. Although the way I see it, Section 35 needs to evolve in ways that also accommodates those other views of the relationship. Whether it can, I don't know. I think that the lesson that I got from this is that you have some very smart and caring people who really put their whole being into listening to what Aboriginal peoples had to say, and given the constraints of Aboriginal public policy, and the Enderpe decision had just come out at the time they were writing the final report. So they also had to wrestle with this in a very in-your-face kind of way. So that was difficult. But nonetheless, I think that it set up this initial problem. Now remember that Section 35 itself is a political fallout from the White Paper of 1969. Right, the White Paper was this proposal to do away with the distinctiveness that Aboriginal people, we weren't even called Aboriginal peoples, that Indians had, and that they would be welcomed. It was a celebration. We would welcome Indians into mainstream Canadian society. We would celebrate this. We would finance, of course, the programs needed to do that. So the fallout from that was this ongoing negotiation through the 70s, which led to Section 35. One thing about Section 35 was the penultimate draft included instead of saying the Aboriginal rights, they were going to talk about inherent Aboriginal rights. So this word inherent, I think, points towards even more so, and it flies in the face of Vanderpeet because it does bring in this idea that well, before means that they possess these kinds of rights, they're inherent in who they are as Aboriginal peoples, this discourse of rights. So I think that it's important that this commission be aware of the past acts of the federal government to respond to various conflicts in Canadian history in ways to try to appease Aboriginal peoples, for one thing, but to do so in a way where the sort of neoliberal discourse of rights stays intact, so that the source, the meaning and source of Aboriginal rights themselves, it remains articulated in the language of culture. And here with residential schools, that's all we can talk about really is culture. I mean, even for me to come and say I want to connect that with Section 35 rights, it seems like a pretty far connection to make. But I think it's important for Aboriginal peoples especially to see that we cannot give that up, that we need to remind the federal government that that the form of our rights is not in this language of culture, but within our own ways of thinking is rooted in these rich historical, philosophical ways of understanding the world that have that kind of political dimension to them. So they're reminders. That's the way that I want to have it understood.
Wajia, Matthew Kunkum Sangasani. It's a gesture that better than you mean. Gagging the data and Angu Decha, Gmawi, you know, Yumit, we know the data moon, we know it's good Mazio, Betagnija. So, Gawem Stubushu, then I said, it's good Mardi, you know, Betagon Chiska. Then, Mam Dreetim Higon. It's my Danish gauge. Ask you had it, Nano. Then they should Dachka, Kaitika. Ogonem Ska Datim Higani. Can you the Bazamon get done, Gai swap to money? Then Yan Inushchicha is Poyatska. I purposely spoke in my language. My name is Matthew Kunkum. I am from the northern Quebec, James Bay. One of my preoccupations has been just sitting here and listening to the intellectual discussions of people who have learned the white man's books and learned them well. And I can't help but think of many stories of how we can connect all this and bring it back home to the people. Probably 98% of people will never read the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People's report. And it makes you wonder how many will actually read the Truth and Reconciliation's report when it comes out in 5 years from now. But I want to share a couple of stories with you, if I may. Just in terms of different philosophies and different understanding and different concepts. I told the story to my father-in-law. We were out hunting, fishing and trapping out on his hunting ground. I gave him a history lesson and said, I went to Trent University, of course, and I went to McGill University. I studied law, etc., political science and economics. But I told him the story and said, did you know that your hunting ground was given away by King Charles to his nephew, Prince Rupert? At the stroke of a pen, your land was given away. And he just sat there, he looked at me and said, what a crazy idea. I mean, you guys are academics, I'm talking about terra nullius, these are principles. And he said, that is crazy. My father, his father, and his father's father have always hunted in this territory. Not once did I see this king, not once did I ever ran into this Prince Rupert that says that this is his land because it was given to him by the stroke of a pen, which is legally recognized by these institutions. So you can see that he was mesmerized and really taken back of how he could be told that this is not his land. And I recall also telling my father's a hunter, he's a fisherman, he's a trapper. So is my grandfather. My grandfather was 115 years old when he died. Never went to school. But he had a wonderful stories to tell about the love of the land, about his philosophy, and how he saw life in itself, and what he dreamed for his children. And here's an elderly man, 115 years old, being asked for his opinions. And yet his opinions do not count. Why? Because he didn't go to university. You didn't get your BA. You didn't get your master's. You didn't get your PhD. Therefore, you're irrelevant. And this is a story that he told me. He said, son, I want you to go to school. And I want you to go and learn those books and learn them well. For we might need them one day to be able to fight and protect our rights and our interests. So I did. After I completed, I went to him and I asked him, I'm finished. And he says, good. Now I'm going to deprogram you. That's what I like to do to you guys up there. The ones that spoke this morning, I would like to deprogram you guys. Because I know at the end of the day, have we done anything real different? We have used the same philosophies. We have used the same textbooks. We have used the same sections of the Constitution. You made references to UN declarations this morning. But those are not Cree philosophies. Those are not Cree ideologies. That is not Cree law. And that will be the challenge for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. How will they be able to take what is being told to them of these stories, of these atrocities that were committed to these children who were removed, taken away from their families, all on the policies of assimilation, to take the Indian out of them? How are you going to translate that? Because you will go into, and I'll give you an example, into the Cree world. In 1975, we were 6,000. Out of that, 3,500 Those are children that were taken away from their families. Some went 2-3 years, went back out on the land as hunters, fishermen, and trappers. And when they appear before these commissions, they will have their own version. My concern is when they tell their stories, whose idea and from what textbook are you going to interpret of the stories that they're going to tell you? Because if you do that, then you will miss the boat. What have we learned from the Council of Reconciliation from Australia? I was there. I was national chief. I was grand chief. I met the people that were involved in the Council of Reconciliation. I met Bishop Tutu, talk about his truth and reconciliation. I met with these philosophers and thinkers trying to find solutions as to how to think outside of the box, do something that we have never done before, to empower people so that they can actually maybe subpoena people, to be able to take these people, these predators, and take them to court. Well, there are limitations on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You cannot subpoena people. As a matter of fact, they're probably very limited as to what the First Nations believe in this country, that they'd be able to tell their stories. Because once those doors are closed, those commissioners will not be able to release any information. Because those individuals want to name people. They want to name institutions. So at the end of the day, what have we really done? Have we created another forum, raised the expectations of our Aboriginal people? So that this may become just another forum where frustrations are raised, expectations are raised, but at the end of the day, it's a letdown. I know most of the stuff is written in stone already, but I'm curious as to what maneuverability that the TRC commissioners would have in terms of once they able to write their stories. Will they stick to the guidelines and their mandate? Or are they going to dare to be able to say, even though this is not our mandate, we're willing to highlight what has been told to us? These are the issues that our people want to deal with. Aside from individual suffering, They will want to talk about their lands being stolen. They will want to talk about their trees being cut. They will want to talk about their rivers being flooded and made to flow backwards. They will want to talk about the loss of language and loss of culture. They will want to talk about it intergenerational, of how you were taken away from residential school and now you cannot teach your own kids to speak your own language or to pass down your customs and traditions to your own children because you were taken away. Have we really learned from the past? Are we really doing anything different? Or is this another repeat, another Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, another study that will collect dust somewhere? What guarantees can be given to the Indian Residence School survivors and to the communities that this will not be so? The academic community will need to be able to advocate. The civil society will need to be able to raise some new ideas. The philosophers should be able to intervene. But I think at the end of the day, it is the individuals, it is the people who were victimized that should have their day. And it should not be constrained by perimeters that are being agreed to. Because if you come to our communities, they will talk to you in Cree. I know. I was part of that group that went and did the community tour on the agreement, explained to our people We had turnouts in our community, unbelievable. We're 17,000 right now. When we went to a community, we had 1,000 people come, want to hear about the agreement. And not one of them asked us a question in English. It's all in Cree. They told their stories in Cree. Why? Because they were grade 1, 2, or 3, and they left the residential school. 5, they went out on the land. But they can articulate of what happened to them. Now, I've asked several questions. I don't expect you people to answer them. But I think their questions need to be pondered on. And I heard the Prime Minister of Australia, Howard, when he made this statement, when he said, current generations shall not be made accountable of the past. I disagree. I say it's the responsibility of the present generation to make sure it never happens again. Have a good day. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kukan. Maybe Val, and maybe we can use this last question to try to conclude, but I think we cannot conclude for this question. We just have to ask to ourselves this question more and more. But
obviously, I can't respond to all of the richness of that presentation. I would like to add another concern, which is that Dale has said that the Royal Commission generated 20,000 pages. The Delgamuukw decision generated 50,000 pages. One of the concerns that I have, my research, a lot of my work has been with the Gikxen. One of the things that happens in that situation was that the people who talked to the court, most of them were elderly. Most of them are now gone. And the next generation of people who aren't as connected to their Adawak, to their land, to who they are as a people. One of the dynamics that occurred was that the court case became a resource for people to understand themselves. Unfortunately, it was a very simplified version of who the Gikxen are. So one of the things that can happen when there's written material about who a people are is that sometimes they're too simple and sometimes they can become incorporated into people's own definitions of themselves. And I think that that has particular consequences insofar as internal conflicts, which all of our communities are now dealing with, whether it's over language, one of the most contested areas there is, or over whether what is sacred or over laws, all of those things are contested at our communities. So there's another lesson, I think, to learn from information that's generated about us.
So I want to thank you all for your presence, your participation. I want to thank the panelists, the reporter, and the translator. Thank you. And I want to